to us, to the death, so we made that. Just before the chair reads that out, I understand the three lines which you'd like to make to the pre-lodge.
Yep, I'd just like to fill in paragraph 48 to read. Additionally, a three-night maximum stay is considered necessary in order to for visitor accommodation to be an adequate or more commercially viable within the airport zone.
Sorry, what paragraph is it?
To be 48. Queenstown Airport Corporation members. In February of this year, Mr. Edgell, as acting chief executive, presented some corporate evidence which set out, among other things, future growth predictions and passenger numbers based on the previous 12-month period. By way of update, our long-term forecast now predict that domestic passenger numbers will double and international passenger numbers will nearly triple by 2026. For the 12 months ending October 2016, Queenstown Airport welcomed a total of 1.7 million passengers. This represents a 19% increase in the previous year's passenger numbers, including a 19% increase in domestic and approximately 18% increase in international passengers. QAC is mindful that there is a need to manage passenger growth in line with community expectations, and the local infrastructure and tourism facilities need to have the capacity to keep pace with this growth. Accordingly, we're currently in the process of undertaking a 30-year master plan. The master plan is intended to provide a roadmap to implement for airport development that continue to serve the local community and region, deliver an excellent visitor experience, maximise asset returns, and generate sustainable growth and returns and value to our community and partners. The master planning process will provide guidance on requirements for future aeronautical operations and opportunities for commercial development. We are working very closely with key stakeholder groups in the development of the master plan and will seek input from the airport and the wider community as the plan takes shape. Of relevance to this hearing, the master plan process will address at a high level future developments and design outcomes for the airport, including the formulation of urban design principles for future development. QAC will engage on the master plan with the airport and wider community next year and anticipates that the feedback received from this engagement will have a bearing on the urban design direction and final urban design principles and guidelines. With respect to the range of activities anticipated at Queenstown Airport in the foreseeable future, it's important for the panel to understand that modern day airports are no longer simply transportation facilities. Today's airports are commercial enterprises and need to create additional revenue streams beyond traditional revenue sources such as landing fees, gate leases and passenger service charges. Additional revenue streams introduce opportunities to make profit, provide the infrastructure investment and to counter-cyclical business reasons. In order to accommodate selective growth in airport operations, including providing the necessary airside and landside infrastructure while remaining competitive, QAC is seeking to establish a broader range of activities than are currently enabled at the airport. The activities QAC seeks to be enabled are consistent with the range and types of activities found at other New Zealand airports. These activities will cater for both airport visitors and workers and will enable QAC to efficiently utilise its land holdings while ensuring that direct aviation function is not compromised in the long term. A common offering at many of both New Zealand and the world's international airports is airport-related visitor accommodation. This type of accommodation is typically located on or within a short walking distance from the main airport terminal and generally caters for transit and short-stay visitors as well as delayed passengers and overnighting airline crew who may may require accommodation at short notice. It is QSN's desire to meet the growing need and demand for alternative and convenient options for their short day transiting, overnighting or delayed passengers, visitors and crew that primarily motivates the inclusion of short stay visitor accommodation into the airport next Tuesday. The airport makes New Zealand also considered Wanaka Airport, and in this respect I note that the Queensland Lakes District Council is in the process of undertaking a consultation on the future governance of Wanaka Airport. Therefore it is premature for QAC to comment on future activities of the airport at this time. However, a strategic review of Wanaka Airport undertaken by Astra Consulting earlier this year identified a range of activities that are contemplated to occur in the short term at Wanaka Airport. As manager, in its capacity of manager at Wanaka Airport, QIC broadly supports the strategic direction set out in the Astra report. With respect to the tenancies at Wanaka Airport, there are a number of leases at the airport ranging from approximately 200 to 2,600 square metres. The majority of these airport tenants hold ground leases. I understand that restrictions on the gross border of non-aviation and non-access ancillary activities are proposed. Based on advice from Mr. Kyle, I understand that that such activities would require resource consent as non-compliant activities. I also understand that this would mean the consent authority could consider the appropriateness or otherwise of these activities establishing at the site in a similar manner to the process followed for the granting of resource consent for the ski distribution warehouse that currently operates at the airport. As such, QAC does not support a restriction of gross floor areas for described activities within the mixed use zone on the airport.
I guess one of the core purposes of this particular chapter is to ensure that the airport's able to deliver people to the district or to the region. It's obvious that that needs to be a viable business. And I'm really just wondering, you know, is the visitor accommodation component of this proposal what you'd be seeing as a make or break for the airport? In terms of ensuring that they would be able to continue to do that?
I wouldn't necessarily term that as a make or break, but it's certainly something that's expected from passengers that travel through international airports and major airports in New Zealand, and it's one of our primary goals to try and deliver an excellent passenger experience and an introduction to Queenstown, and so be able to have the opportunity to provide that visitor accommodation on the doorstep to suit the needs of those I described is pretty critical, I think, to deliver that good passenger experience.
So is there any evidence in terms of steering group, focus group type thing, research by the airport about actually needing accommodation on site rather than a short walk to other accommodation? Or?
Obviously we haven't got the ability to provide accommodation at this point, so that is what we're seeking. So we're at early stages now thinking about what it might provide and what visitors may require as far as walking distances and proximity to the airport. But I think that what we've seen in other airports, Wellington Airport is developing an airport hotel on the terminal. Auckland International Airport has a hotel a short distance across a forecourt road to a hotel, and the expectations and use of those facilities show that there is a demand and a desire to have the proximity to the airport terminal.
Do you think it would prevent people or create a barrier to people coming to visit the airport, come through the airport in the future, if there wasn't such a recommendation?
I don't think it was clear cut as that, and I think ultimately people are not coming to visit the airport. that we are facilitating people visit Queenstown as the airport, but it is another facility that will enable their stay to be more enjoyable or offer them alternatives in the transiting passengers, very short stay visitors, delays, and so forth.
Yes, good afternoon. you talk about the visitor accommodation being part of providing a good passenger experience. Is it possible to provide that good passenger experience, do you think, by linking with other providers who might provide accommodation, utilising a short bus trip or whatever to get to that accommodation? Would that be a suitable option?
I think all options are suitable. I think that what we've seen through the study that was done through Project Palace from the Ministry of Trade and Enterprise showed that there's a severe shortage of accommodation, and my understanding of this statistic shows 1,400 room shortage in the next 10 years of hotel rooms in Queenstown. I think that we, as a community, we need to look at further accommodation across the board and provide it in help in whatever way that we can, and the airport hotel model, I guess, provides one option for providing that visitor accommodation that suits a certain sector of that travelling public and would add to the overall offer that Queenstown can give to passengers and visitors to the area.
How do you sort of compare, and this is just hypothetical, if there was another hotel off the airport site and you had to take, the passengers had to take a short bus trip or whatever, still walkable, but you had a bus option, how would that compare in terms of providing this objective of good passenger experience and comparing an on-site?
Passengers are a diverse group of people and everyone's going to have different needs and different propensities to travel to either get a different offer or a different price offer. In the case of delayed flights where there may be things changing relatively quickly across the airport, I think would be very attractive. For overnight and cruise for evening flights coming in later in the evening, the proximity of the hotel to the terminal I think is also very attractive. So it's a matter of degree, but it is certainly attractive having it very close to the terminal.
Now, in your main brief of evidence, you talked about the three-night maximum stay.
Yes.
And you told us there in your brief it was necessary and appropriate to accommodate weekend visitors from Australia. Now, those weekend visitors from Australia, in what way are they different from, can I use the phrase, sort of usual visitors to Queenstown? What's distinctive or different about that type of category of visitor?
At this stage, the frequency of international flights is not as frequent as the flights through to Auckland, for example. So I haven't got the exact schedule in front of me, but the ability to have a little bit more flexibility around the maximum stay to accommodate the lower frequency of international flights would be beneficial.
Well, and would you agree with me that, if you like, if we're putting these users of the intended visitor accommodation into categories, would you accept that a weekend visitor from Australia would fit into a different category than somebody who's experienced a delayed flight, or somebody who wants to just simply transit, meaning short stay, and they're off the next day, or the airline pilots and crew?
Yes, they are. They've got different groups with slightly different needs.
Yeah. And the needs of the weekend visitor I'm just struggling to understand the level of connection that they might have with the intended visitor accommodation on site. Their needs can be served elsewhere shortly, but it has to stay on the, not necessarily a linkage between what they're doing and visitor accommodation provision on site at the airport.
Not necessarily, however, I think the what we've looked at through the introduction of evening flights is the ability for someone to come down on Friday night, spend the weekend skiing and leave on Sunday night for a cluster, and take advantage of a convenient, close accommodation option that doesn't focus on, that focuses purely on the accommodation and allows them to make full use of the weekend hours to do whatever activity they've chosen to undertake for them.
Right, thank you.
The in your summary in paragraph 7, you've talked about the master plan process, and how the airport proposes to do that. Do you think there should be some link between the master plan when it's completed and the zone provision? The other question, you referred to it both in your, alluded to it in your summary and referred to it in, clearly in your main brief of evidence about the need for the airport to be competitive. Mm. What other airport is Queensland Airport competing with in attracting and getting passengers to Queenstown?
Competitive in as far as airlines have a choice about which airport they can fly to and which airport they choose to put additional capacity on.
Well, we have a limited range of airlines. I mean, we all know who they are.
Yes.
If each of those airlines is just to fly passengers to Queenstown, where else could they land to deliver those passengers? Isn't that what competition you're alluding to?
Yeah, I mean, potentially, I mean, I think at the moment the figures that we understand is approximately 30% of the visitors to Queenstown arrive by air, and 70% of visitors arrive by other means, which is really only unless you work road travel. So there's a competitive between air travel and road travel, and there's probably just the ability to sustain financially the overall operation of the airport.
Okay, thank you. I can just make some points on that last question too. Jetstar, for example, no longer has the Queensland Christchurch route, and the airport operator is the level of expert decided that it will be an economic route to do so. So I suppose my understanding is that airlines won't bring passengers to a destination because they want to bring passengers to a destination. They'll do it because it's profitable for them to do so. But if it's not profitable for them to do so, that's why it's not the natural result. Thank you, Mr. Day.
Start with my summary evidence on paragraph 2, if that's okay. This evidence provides a short summary of my statement of evidence of the 18th of November and includes brief comments on the evidence of Mr. Hunt and the summary evidence of Dr. Charles. So starting with Mr. Hunt's evidence and under the issue topic of Appendix 13, in paragraphs 11 to 17, Mr. Hunt identifies that the sound insulation construction specified in Appendix 13 would not be adequate for hotels located at high noise levels inside the air noise boundary. I agree with Mr. Hunt, and consequently the proposed visitor accommodation rule, which was based on PC 35, needs to be amended to eliminate the reference to Appendix 13 of the operating district plan. Appendix 13 was developed primarily for buildings where the external environment would not be any noisier than 68 dB LDM. This being the noisiest possible environment for buildings containing ASANs in the proximity to Queenstown Airport due to zoning constraints. Based on extensive measurements Marshall Bay Acoustics have made in houses around Auckland, Wellington and Queenstown Airports, I am confident the Appendix 13 constructions will ensure a house located at 68 dB will achieve 40 dB inside. But I agree that Appendix 13 would not be an appropriate construction method for areas of higher external noise levels. The PC 35 rules provide two options for ASANs in this noise environment, i.e. up to 68 dB, to either build to Appendix 13 or alternatively demonstrate the design can achieve an internal noise level of 40 dB. The Appendix 13 option was included to provide residential developments with a standard construction that would avoid the need for an acoustic design certificate otherwise being required in every case. I agree with Mr. Hunt that Appendix 13 would not be appropriate for visitor accommodation in a high noise inside the air noise boundaries. I recommend the Appendix 13 option is deleted from the proposed airport zone rule, VA rule, leaving the requirement to demonstrate that an internal sound environment of 40 dB will be achieved indoors as the primary and only option. From MDA's experience with addressing noise-related issues for a number of airport hotels, it's my view, contrary to Mr. Hunt, that there are no technical difficulties designing to achieve 40 dB for a hotel at Queenstown Airport. I note that Dr. Charles agrees that VA in the airport zone can be appropriately designed to mitigate noise effects. And I should perhaps correct that. It was Mr. Hunt's view in his initial evidence that it couldn't be achieved, but I understand yesterday under some questioning that he perhaps accepted that hotels can be designed to achieve appropriate internal levels yesterday. So I think probably all three of us are on agreement there. under the general heading of the Airport Noise Standard, NZS 6805, in paragraph 18, Mr. Hunt misquotes the New Zealand standard where he states the recommendations of NZS 6805 prohibit noise-sensitive development, such as visitor accommodation. From my reading of NZS 6805, the standard does not mention visitor accommodation in any way. The length of stay. In paragraph 19, Mr. Hunt disagrees that restricting the number of days achieves any reduction in stroke mitigation of effects. Mr. Hunt's approach implies that a person exposed to aircraft noise for 365 days a year experiences the same extent of adverse effects as somebody who experiences noise for only one night of the year. This is illogical in my opinion. Mr. Hunt also states, I cannot see how NBA can be sure that guests will only stay for one or two nights. Dr. Charles is fairly relaxed about the length of stay and suggests no limitations required. In his words, so long as any visitor accommodation in the Queenstown Airport Zone is not used for long-term residential type use. In my opinion, greater control on duration of stay is appropriate and necessary in order to ensure that the VA is in practice short stay. In my opinion, this would be very easy to implement in the booking system and very easy to enforce on the records. Noise-induced awakenings or sleep disturbance, some terminology. In paragraph 40, Mr. Hunt predicts indoor single-event noise levels of 67 dB to 675 dB SEL for VA in the airport zone, and that this will cause an unsatisfactory level of awakenings of 5% to 7% of people using VA within the air noise boundary. I disagree with this opinion on two grounds. I should just mention that don't confuse the decibels in this paragraph, which specifically rates it SELs rather than the LDNs. Just very quickly, LDN is the total noise exposure over the 24-hour period, and the SEL is the noise energy from one aircraft event, so it's a single event measure. Firstly, the three reasons I disagree with that opinion. Firstly, a level of 7% of people experiencing awakenings would not necessarily be regarded as significant. A threshold of 10% of the population affected is often used in setting noise standards. For example, NZ 6805 proposes 55 dB LDN, that's the total noise exposure, as the threshold below which the noise level is regarded as satisfactory for residential accommodation. This overseas research by Maidema shows that 11% of the population are highly noisy at 55 dB LDN. Fairly closely relates to the 10% threshold. The adjacent Remarkables Park Zone has residential and visitor accommodation located between the 55 and 65 dB aircraft noise contours, where 11% to 28% of the population are predicted to be highly annoyed by the MIDEMA findings. Secondly, as stated in paragraph 39, Mr. Hunt has used the performance of the Appendix 13 construction to achieve the indoor sound levels of 67 to 75 dB SEL that he quotes. As stated earlier, the Appendix 13 construction would not be used for VA accommodation inside the high noise areas, and lower internal noise levels and lower percentage awakenings would thus be achieved. The evidence of Dr. Charles. In paragraph 9A, Dr. Charles agrees that VA could be located within the airport zone with appropriate mitigation, but then goes on to state that VA should remain within the definition of ASAM. On reflection, I agree with Dr. Charles that short stay VA is noise sensitive, as it needs to achieve a reasonable internal noise level for sleeping. However, it is important to note that short stay VA is considerably less noise sensitive than long-term visitor accommodation and residential activity for the reasons described in my evidence and summarised below. For these reasons, reverse sensitivity planning rules applying to highly noise sensitive activities, which is prohibited in some areas, should not apply to short stay VA. I would like to delete paragraph 24 from our primary evidence and replace it with the sentence, short stay VA is significantly less noise sensitive than long stay VA and residential, but this requires sound insulation in high noise areas to protect sleep. Under the issue of the noise limits and the nighttime hours, specified the minimized noise limits. The noise rules in district plans often have different noise limits and sometimes different cutoff times for day and night for different zones. Mr. Carr has provided a useful summary of the noise limits that apply in zones around Queenstown Airport in his summary evidence. I'm sorry you haven't received that as yet, but you'll be able to look through that shortly. The general approach to setting noise limits is to provide more stringent limits in quiet areas and more lenient limits in areas already affected by higher noise levels. For example, non-productive rural areas might have noise limits of, and I've tried to abbreviate things here to make them shorter and easier to read, 50 daytime, 40 nighttime, 70 L max at nighttime. And noisy areas close to airports or the city centre might have 55, 45, 75 dB limits, basically 5 dB less stringent. Mr. Hunt and Dr. Charles recommend the more stringent noise limits and cutoff times should apply to the airport zone, and they've proposed 54 to 70 with cutoff time from the night time being 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. without any justification why this area and the immediate surrounding area is particularly quiet. The cutoff time of 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. is a most unusual time frame that I have not seen in other district plans, and in my opinion is unduly restrictive. I prefer the Chapter 36, Section 42A reporting officer's evidence that 55, 45, 75 dB and 0700 to 2200 hours are appropriate limits for activities in the airport zone. So, just very briefly, four paragraphs summarising my position on these various issues. Short stay VA is less sensitive to noise than long stay VA because of three reasons. One, the visitor expectation of aircraft noise when they stay in an airport hotel. Two, the short duration of the noise exposure, that's the 1 day versus 365 days. And three, no outdoor areas for high noise exposure. On this basis, VA should be allowed in the airport zone, in my opinion, subject to restrictions on the length of stay, outdoor areas, and sound insulation rules. The noise limits for activities in the airport zone received in surrounding zones should be consistent with the noise rules recommended by the Section 42A reporting officer, which in Rule 36.5.15, that's in her reply evidence on behalf of QLDC. And finally, the rules for the LSCZ should be consistent with the rules for other zones surrounding the airport in respect of the mitigation of aircraft noise and should contain the revised provisions for mechanical ventilation as per QAC's evidence for Chapter 36 of the proposed plan.
Yes, good afternoon, thank you. Now, Mr. Hunt, in his principal evidence, raised a number of issues. One of the issues he raised early on was that allowing visitor accommodation, even with the qualifications or conditions that you propose, would create an unwelcome precedent, and that it makes allowance for ASA units to be established within high aircraft noise areas within the airport mixed-use zone. How do you respond to that criticism? Or concern, I should say.
Yes, I think if it's confined to short-stay visitor accommodation, that if a precedent means that it allows other short stay visitor accommodation to come along, I don't have any difficulty with that. I don't think it weakens the position on long stay visitor accommodation, which is very clear. As I've said in my primary evidence, that the Millbrook type of development was proposed to be located in that zone, it would be inappropriate. So a precedent for short stay, yes, that may be appropriate.
In your sort of evaluation, this issue of short stay is, I've understood that to be quite critical to your overall opinion.
Yes, for a professional to maintain consistency and of the approach that I've taken on this topic over many years, it is critical. But like all noise issues, there's a grey area and where one night, two nights, three nights, 10 nights, where the transition is a grey area, and people have different opinions, different noise experts have different opinions. Dr. Charles is more liberal than me. I started off at one or two and I've stuck with that, but it doesn't mean that three would suddenly instantly be hugely worse or change the situation. It's a grey transition, but my position is one to two.
Based on your skill, your experience, you've landed on the one to two?
Yes. I should add, as far as I'm aware, none of the other airport hotels that we've gone from a design point of view, not a resource consent point of view, have any restrictions on that, and it just naturally works out like that. But from my professional position, that's my view, is a constraint that makes sure it is short stay.
And again, as an expert witness, if there was another proposal and it had similar constraints, both in terms of design and the short stay element, and it was within the same sort of position vis-a-vis airport noise, you'd be able to support that proposal?
Yes, and with those constraints that you mentioned, but also the other one, that it is clearly an airport hotel located next to it. I was thinking last night that if a hotel was built right on the lakefront there, overlooking the lake, right under the flight paths, extremely high noise levels and whatever, a resort-type hotel can't be the zone, but I was just trying to think of an example. And people could arrive there not knowing there's an airport there and not be aware of it. So that first issue of my three issues that make it acceptable is that expectation that it is an airport hotel and they'll be experiencing airport noise. So to me, it needs to be associated close by the airport and clearly connected with the airport.
Well, it could be connected to the extent that it could be close by in terms of not necessarily on the airport site per se, but it could be located within, you know, visual distance of the airport, so you could see the airport functioning.
Yeah. As long as it meets those requirements, and that's why I gave that example of it down the hill there in front of the lake where you might not be aware of it, then that first element would disappear.
Yeah. But that first element can be achieved by being in close proximity to the airport.
Yes.
You don't actually have to be on the airport site, do you?
It starts transitioning. For example, at Auckland, the Ibis Hotel is probably a kilometre from it, and in Queenstown, the Commodore Hotel, Mr. Hunt mentioned, Commodore Hotel in Christchurch, is approximately 2 kilometres from the main runway. And so it's a short hop, but you definitely wouldn't feel it's associated with the airport.
But there's a lot of other activities going on between, say, the Commodore Hotel in Christchurch and the airport. There's a separation, both in terms of distance, and there's not necessarily a visual connection there, is there,
in
that context.
That's correct.
Yeah. The circumstance I'm talking to you about, though, is that if there was still a visual connection, you could see the aircraft coming and going, they were really visible, you're in close proximity.
Yes.
I think you're telling me you'd be able to support a proposal such as that.
Yes.
And on the issue of monitoring and control, you've made mention that you don't think there'll be any problems with being able to monitor and control the duration of stay. So can I take from that then, it would be your expectation that the operator of the visitor accommodation on the airport site, if somebody was wanting to stay for a longer period, the operator would have to say, well, no, you can't stay.
Well, the way of handling it diplomatically, I imagine, would be we can accommodate you for these 3 days, but it's the 3 days, but it's there's no vacancies the time after or something like that.
Yeah.
Or it could be completely open as you can't stay for longer than 2 days.
And that's probably a better way of doing it right up front.
Yeah, that's right, because then they might want to shift walking back by 2 days and then suddenly they do that. Yeah.
He didn't see any justification for what was now proposed, and secondly, he was concerned that the effects hadn't really been properly assessed. So what do you say to those two criticisms or concerns?
Yes, I'm not aware that every rule for every zone that's proposed to be modified or changed in a district plan review, if it goes through a full, what we'd call a noise assessment of effects for every one of those. So I would agree with him that there hasn't been an assessment of effects. The setting of noise rules is generally done by receiving a series of opinions from acoustic experts on what they think is reasonable and the council planners, and coming to a joint opinion on those. It's not my experience, but a full assessment of effects would ever be done on that.
All right, thank you.
Just on that last point, in paragraph 29 of your evidence.
Of my summary evidence?
No, your substantial evidence.
Yes.
You refer there to town centre zone.
Yes.
And I just wonder if you consider the provisions applying to the town centre zone in full, when you've made that final appropriate zone.
Quite sure what you mean in full, but I've certainly skimmed them, so I'm sure there's some more detailed assessment that I'm very willing to look at.
Well, the point is that the town centre zone noise rules that you refer to establish limits of daytime 60 dBA from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Yes.
Within the zone, do you take account of the other provisions that says that those rules don't apply to activities to the noise received in adjoining zones. In other words, the noise received in the adjoining zones has to meet the standards of the adjoining zones, in particular the residential zones.
Yes, to answer your question directly, I didn't take that into account. It was really the concept that Dr. Charles was proposing, that you take into account that when people are already affected by noise, you take that into account when you're setting noise limits.
Isn't there a parallel between Queenstown Town Centre and the surrounding residential area, the noise that's created by activities in the centre and the surrounding, the effects that might occur in the surrounding residential area, and the land-based activities at the airport and the effects they may have on the surrounding residential area?
Yes, I think there definitely is a parallel there, and if I was setting noise limits for both of those, I would be setting higher noise limits for those residential areas adjacent to the town centre and adjacent to the airport than I would be setting for the outer residential areas and the low density residential areas. And I think there definitely is a case for setting higher noise limits for those areas that are located immediately adjacent to town centres and airports that make noise.
Any questions?
Yes, well, thank you. I'm just trying to get a sort of model of what 40 DBL actually means. If I was staying in a accommodation that was built to a standard where there was a 40 DBL inside, standard level, inside, would I expect to experience noise induced awakening?
At a very low level, it'll be around the bottom of Mr. Hunt's curve. It's a very difficult question to answer, and I understand your difficulty with this noise terminology, because the 40 LDN is really it is a total noise exposure for the day type measure, and really probably setting design criteria for, and sorry to finish that off, that's what's used for setting the internal criteria for a house that's lived in 24 hours a day. But when you're setting criteria for a short-term visitor accommodation, sleep disturbance becomes the only issue, and it probably would do better having a specific rule designed into one of these single event noise levels that Mr. Hunt has referred to. But at the moment, the rules are simplistically kept to be consistent with the other areas as used the 40 LDN. In effect, it'll turn out to be roughly achieve roughly the same as designing those single events. When we design these hotels, we're working on one at Wellington at the moment, one in Christchurch, the average criterion tends to determine things in a similar way to a single criterion. But to explain your initial question of what does it actually sound like, and we had this difficulty with the Wellington Airport client, for example, and what we did was set up a demonstration. We got recordings, digital recordings of aircraft, set up speakers in a hotel room in town and play at different levels to them so they could hear it. It's really the only way that you can try and relate the decibel levels of what people hear. It is very difficult. But it will achieve a reasonable level of protection, the 40 dB. If it was a five-star type hotel, they probably would naturally design for something slightly lower than that, maybe 35.
So, could you agree that you can build to a higher level or a lower threshold, 35? But then, in summary, that still people that would be having short-term accommodation at an airport would be, I guess, more open to potentially having some disturbance by noise. So, you suggest that even at that lower threshold, then there would still be disturbance, or would you be able to cancel out that disturbance?
If you look at Mr. Hunt's statements on page 12, scale, so you can't go to it's very difficult to go to a level that absolutely wipes everybody out from being sleep disturbed. So because of that exponential shape that occur. But the 40 LDN will roughly relate to and it's a bit hard to do without checking the numbers will roughly relate to the 60 dB SEL mark. It's probably the simplest equation there.
So sorry, say that again.
So the 40, this is a single event criterion graph, SEL 60 dB, and I'm guessing very roughly that based on a moderate number of aircraft, and at the moment, of course, quite interesting there. There actually aren't any true night flights at Queenstown between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. But assuming a moderate number of aircraft, then that might be roughly 40 LDN, i.e. the design criterion would be achieved at that point. So you can see there's still some people that will be awakened in that situation. But if you slide it down 10 dB, you still get some. So, that's...
I did question on this particular graph and the research that went into it, and it wasn't specific to accommodation or to airports or, I guess, in terms of the summary, that there's an expectation by visitors to airport VA that they would expect aircraft noise and be okay with that. Have you got any research that suggests that that is actually the case? Or because this particular research didn't specifically deal with that issue?
No, I'm fairly confident this research wouldn't have included short-stay visitor hotels. My understanding is that it is specifically related to aircraft noise, and it is specifically related to residential accommodation around airports.
Okay, so do you know any additional research that would suggest that visitors are happy to have more likely to, I guess, be okay with the disturbance at an airport in relation to at a VA in relation to an airport than to anywhere else?
I'm not aware of any research on that. It's really a personal opinion that based on my personal experience of staying by hotels and my general noise experience, that one of the key factors that determines people's response to noise, and there is a lot of research on this, this is a general concept, one of the key factors is whether people use the noise source themselves, whether they know something has been tried to be done about the noise, and all of those are key factors that go into determining people's response, and that has been shown in research that people who use trains to go to work as transport manner are less disturbed by train noise than people who don't use it.
So, when you were considering the effects of noise on the short-stay visitors, the two-day visitors, is what you've just talked about the full extent of the consideration of noise effects on those visitors?
I'm not completely understanding your question yet.
Oh, as I understand your evidence, the base proposition is these visitors will be short-stay visitors, so therefore the level of disturbance on those visitors is either acceptable or it won't lead to complaints. Okay?
Yeah.
However, I don't see in your evidence any assessment of effects on those persons, even though they are short-term visitors or short-term stayers or the duration is short. So my question then was, is your assessment of effects basically what you've just responded to and answered my colleague's question? Is that the full extent of the assessment of effects on those short-stay visitors?
I think it is, and to go together in the background of these relatively low levels of wakings in Mr. Hunt's graph, even for longer term stay type people, that is in the background of my assessment, is there's a low percentage of wakings, and taking into account that people awaken naturally between 3 and 7 times a night, everybody, we all do, we don't realise it most of the time and we go straight back to sleep, but there is sleep disturbance studies show this, and so that level of percentage of wakings is generally a low level, so just adding that to the overall assessment of effects.
Thank you.
Okay.
Now, unless anyone has any objections, we will go through until 1:30, so that we'll get this part finished.
Yes, no, it would be great for that.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairman.
Section 2, if you like.
Yeah, I've got a summary statement which I will take you through if you like.
Yes,
I deal firstly with this issue around the extent of the proposed airport zone. And as you know, the current plan of attack is to effectively match the airport's designation, proposed designation area, with an airport zone. And a similar land use zone is also now proposed for all designated areas at Wanaka. In my view, it is appropriate for the underlying land use zone to recognise that airport related activities are the predominant land use activities occurring on the site. This approach also overcomes potential consenting inefficiencies created by the operative land use zone, which is the general zone, which does not provide for the range of activities reasonably anticipated by the relevant designations, or for that matter, at the airport itself. Much of the land area at both airports is dedicated towards in the industry airside airport operations. Queensland Airport, the extent of airside or operational land is shown in the figure attached as Appendix A. Maybe I'll just complete the paragraph and then I'll take it to Appendix A. The activities set out within the definition of airport activity occur on this land currently. What this shows is that what this shows is that land which is left over and available to people for later activities is defined is reasonably limited in extent. Notably, at Queenstown and to a lesser extent at Wanaka, more land is required for east side operations. This was the primary reason for QAC initiating designation proceedings over the adjacent Lot 6 land, which is owned by RPL in 2010. Now, let me just find the appendix A. Do you have appendix A in front of you?
Yes.
What that shows is effectively the area of land at Queenstown Airport, which is deemed currently, the date of production of this drawing, which was, I think, 2000, and I think it was 2010, which shows the area of what's termed operational land in the brownie orange colour. And the green land is the airport owned land, which is land side rather than air side, if you like. Now, some things to note which are quite important. If you look at the, I'll just point to it if you like, a little bit of a version here, which might be helpful. If you look at this land here, at the northern extent of the runway, that you'll know as the Risa. That's the Risa land. I would actually turn that to the operational land, and the reason that's not shown as operational land is because at the point in time this diagram was produced, that Risa was just still being completed. But that's Risa, that's effectively unused for any other purpose of Risa. Risa is runway and safety area, so interpret. The other interesting point to note, I think, is much of this land here, whilst it's owned by QAC, is actually in the Plan Change 19 area and is zoned according to the Plan Change 19 provisions.
I was going to ask if it would help us if you could just do an amendment to that to show us where the boundaries of the airport zone is proposed, and we don't mind if you get that to us by Monday or Tuesday. But that would be very helpful, because at the moment I can see that comparing it to the planning maps that some is in the stone and some is in Franklin Flats, and the same at the event centre, is all of that green land within the airport zone in that area by the event centre.
I think it would be worthwhile me getting some graphic person to properly draw this map up for you, because I overnight made some amendments to it to see what was usable and not. And roughly, that boundary between PC19 and the airport zone cuts across here, but I'll make sure that this plan is produced properly for you.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Is it worthwhile just indicating on this map also where Lot 6 is suggested?
The notice of requirement for the QAC is issued effectively relates to this land here, and half of that
block.
That isn't subject to the zoning question at the moment.
Right.
No, because that would remain with the underlying zoning. Of the Marcos Park zone.
Yeah.
Yes.
At least at the moment, depending on the outcome of the North Zone.
Irrespective of the outcome, it will be the Marcos Park zone.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I guess another point to note about this land here is you can see the runway strip here, and there are some separation requirements that are mandated by the more or less by civil aviation, to avoid any structures between the runway and a line 150 metres outside of the runway. So whilst that green strip appears quite generous, there are some constraints in terms of being able to build structures in there for operational reasons.
Wouldn't it would help us then if the in doing that graphic, if your airside boundary included those setbacks that yes. required by civil aviation,
mm-hmm.
and that would then make it clear which lane is clearly airside and undevelopable.
Yes. The other thing to note, I suppose, is the effect of the obstacle limitation designation, which has some constraining effect on the height of structures.
Mm.
And that too could be superimposed on this plan to show you the amount of available developable land on the side of the runway.
Yes.
So what you have in front of you is effectively a summary of what's left over that's shown in green. Now, it's also important to say to you that area of green around Tumen, which you can see there in the south of the drawing, in the fullness of time that may need to change. You've heard that the airport is going through some master planning exercises at the moment, and one of the issues and one of the drivers one of the issues that was confronted through the Lot 6 proceedings was the long-term presence of the Crosslink runway. That Crosslink runway has been there for a long time and it currently serves as a useful function for general aviation activities. But my understanding is that at some point in the future, the capacity of the airport and the airspace around it might lead to constraining effects on the ability of the airport to retain the Crosslink runway. And the natural future use of that Crosslink runway area in particular could be put up more green, if you like. So the airport is currently confronted by a need to provide more and more open space for scheduled aircraft, more and more terminal space, more car parking, and that on-vacant land could ultimately be dedicated to that purpose. And in the airport's mind, that would be a natural corroborative to what occurred on Lot 6 as well. But the point at which that occurs in the future is unknown. And depends a good deal on the rate of growth and shape of aircraft. But the point I'm trying to make is that this whole zoning question is likely to be reasonably dynamic over time, and it's perhaps in some ways an answer to the question that we put to Ms. Bolt this morning. Well, if you've got this land that is primarily currently dedicated just to airside or operational type activities, why not just rely on designation? And certainly insofar as that land is concerned, the Crosslink runway optimised currently, that could well evolve through time, and its current airside function could be replaced by a more supportive function. Now, whether that occurs along and adjacent to the main runway is probably less likely because, as you know, the main runway is the key asset that the airport has. So, get a more worked up version of this, of this diagram if it's helpful. I think I've got to three range of activities.
Yes.
As set out in my evidence, achieve modern equals a highly sophisticated and dynamic land uses which legitimately encompass a broad range of activities in order to provide for these advanced aircraft passengers, crew, ground staff, people, workers, and those that need to be reached. The airports often provide for a range of industrial or logistical land uses as such. This is either provide direct servicing to the aviation industry or be directly funded. It is therefore important to the zone to provide sufficient flexibility to properly enable for land to be developed necessary to respond to changing demands that arise in the region. It therefore remains my view that the activities provided for within the zone should be sufficient in order to meet these imperatives over time. With respect to the concerns raised by Mr. Sargent regarding the potential effects arising from a broad range of activities being provided at Queensland Airport, Moments Holden regarding the effects of Wanaka Airport. I note that both airports are land limited and significant areas will continue to be required to facilitate aviation activities, which has gone through. Concerns about a proliferation of unassociated commercial uses are, in my view, at least overstated. With respect to definitions of airport and airport related activities, I understand that the panel is potentially interested in consolidating these definitions. And to assist, we ran a little exercise in the office yesterday to see how these things compared and put them side by side on the page. And appendix B shows is that, what I've intended to do is just put the respective definitions side by side so you can spot the difference if you like. And when you go through that exercise, it's fair to say that the differences aren't that substantial. And
well, in fact, when you read in both the airport activity definitions, it says including but not limited to, whatever follows is irrelevant, really, isn't it?
Can I come back to that not limited to in a minute? Because I have a view about that, the use of that.
Well, I'm just talking about the word say.
Should we deal with it now?
Yeah.
When I step back and take a look at those words, I actually question the utility. I think in terms of rule drafting, those words are not particularly helpful.
That's perhaps an understatement.
So on that basis, I would suggest that those words, but not limited to, should be deleted from the definition.
The other, well, we're talking about that definition of aircraft and airport activity. Probably the significant difference is that the Queenstown one provides for the international aspects, which aren't provided for it. Does it really matter if the definition of airport activity and a singular definition provides for those activities? If Wanaka has an airport activity, it's not compulsory that it takes up every aspect of it. Planning is that the RMA is permissive, not obligatory, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly what my thinking got to when we did this exercise yesterday. In the end, I think, with a bit of good drafting, there could be a single.
Could you assist us? Could you assist us in supplying a single term for each? Yes. By Monday would be good.
Yes.
And that will save us spending time on questioning you on that now.
Yes.
And if anything arises, we'd like to do it by the time issue of money for asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same for the airport related activity. I can't myself as a planner understand why we need two definitions, because we've got two airports.
Yeah. And look, I don't disagree with that. I think one of the other questions you had, I think I picked this up from a reporting of the proceedings. I understood that you had a question as to whether or not the definition should prescribe the activities, or whether the activities could be prescribed in the rule itself.
Well, I was thinking of some of those more peripheral activities, such as the toy museum, which arguably isn't an airport-related activity, and even the war wheels and wheels probably is not an airport-related activity.
No.
Although they are listed there.
Right.
So we can probably move on to section 4 then.
Yes. So dealing with issues around build form and urban design, as Kira made in chief, the key build form standards are largely consistent with the surrounding land use zones on Franklin Flats and provide for efficient use of increasing use of land to instantly attack Queenstown Airport. The panel will have noted from my evidence that in order to assist in better managing the effects of build form, I have suggested that all buildings should comprise controlled activities, which is the case with the existing airport mix zone in the operative plan. This should assist in meeting one of the concerns expressed in the submission by RPL, and I note that Mr. Sargent has recommended a similar approach. Suggested matters of control are intended to achieve the same outcomes as the additional matters of consideration attached to the outline plan that I suggested in evidence at the designation hearing. They are directed at managing the effects of the form, scale and appearance of buildings within the zone. Notwithstanding this, I understand that QAC is committed to providing a memorable airport experience for airport users and comprises one of its key management objectives. As set out by Ms. Treasurer, QAC is currently in the process of reviewing its airport master plan and new design guidelines that have been developed in tandem with this review. Noise. There has been a reasonable amount of discussion of both the Chapter 17 and Chapter 36 hearings relating to the noise limits for land-based activities at Queenstown Airport. I have prepared a table which compares the operative and proposed district plan noise limits for the airport and the surrounding zones for the assistance of the panel. And that's at Appendix C. And I might just rather than take you through that, I'll take a look at that ourselves. You've heard from Mr. Day already that he thinks because the airports are inherently noisy environments, then the tolerance to noise in adjacent zones should be calibrated slightly differently. And I simply referred upon his expert views in that in paragraph 5.2 with respect to that measure. So visitor accommodation. Having considered the evidence of the relevant acoustic experts, I consider that further evidence are required to develop standard 15.17.5.8 to ensure that visitor accommodation is constructed to the purpose added to mitigate the effects of airport noise, and again, that's just a matter of reflecting upon the technical discussion that has preceded this. And again, it's set out of Appendix D, but it simply deals with the comparative lack of utility between the Appendix 13 standards and actually just setting a 40 dB limit inside the building. Section 32, I understand that Mr. Sargent has criticised the number of elements of the Section 32 evaluation for the airport zone. In particular, he says that the Section 32 evaluation is inward looking. I note that the key surrounding land use zones are not subject to the proposed district plan review process. it may be that land outside of the current import boundary could also be considered for inclusion within the import zone in the future. That would inevitably necessitate a forcing consideration under another plan promulgation process. And I just make a note there about Plan Change 50 involvement ahead. I was the primary author of Plan Change 50 and attended the hearing and subsequent running for hearing for this plan change. I'm therefore happy to take any questions you might have if there are any around the interplay between proposed airport zone and zoning provisions inherent in Plan Change 50, if that's useful. And item 8, gross floor area is Wanaka Airport. With respect to Wanaka Airport, I remain of the view that a maximum gross floor area is not required for airport related activities. As previously described, existing land constraints will restrict the development of such activities. The location of such activities will be located within the building and subject to control of the status. Therefore, any amendment to the consent can be reversed via the consent process. I also understand that the government's expert, Mr. Heath, does not consider that a restriction on airport or airport related activities is required. The inclusion of gross floor areas at one of the airport therefore seems only to be intended to apply to activities falling outside of those activities as defined. Such activities, you know, from the table are non-compliant in any event. My view is there's no need for the limits proposed on that basis. And briefly on hours of operation for completeness, I note that in paragraph 6.45 of my evidence in chief, I use an example of aircraft appear in service and requiring overnight access and use of the airport as an example of why the hours of operation at one of the airport should not be restricted. I note that the relevant rule only relates to cafes, food and beverage facilities and retail activities. Notwithstanding, such activities may also require overnight access to the airport, for example, for food preparation purposes. I therefore maintain that this rule is unnecessary. And I'm happy to take your questions.
Mr. Sargent, in his evidence, he spent some time being critical of the sort of Section 32 type analysis in terms of lack of consideration of alternatives. Now, you've given some view about that, but the impression he gained in his state system of evidence is that the impression taken from the existing 32 analysis was it was really just about zoning the airport and not solving a resource management issue. And I really wanted your response to that. Because it seems to me there's a fair bit of kind of inward looking going on here, if I can use that phrase.
Certainly cognizant of his criticism. My view is that, putting to one side the extent of the zoning for a moment, there is a clear need to update the existing, what is currently equal mixed use zone provisions, because they are, as I say, maybe somewhere they date from 1995. They no longer truly reflect what occurs at the airport. Or will occur in the future. And there's a degree of modernisation required in terms of the provisions and the activities provided there. And in terms of dealing with the extent of the zone, in the preparatory phases of this part of the plan, the consideration was, well, currently rural. Is that an appropriate fit given the current activities? And the conclusion drawn by the council and the QAC and contributing to that process was probably it wasn't a great fit, and that perhaps a look to what other airports around the country were doing in plans was appropriate. And the exercise was undertaken to review what those other airports did, and I think I mentioned two-year designation here, and that Auckland, for example, has its own two-year designation. That is airport related, and you have some evidence about the Auckland situation. Wellington also has an airport zone, doesn't have a designation after all of its land, which is a matter that's currently reconsidering, and so forth. So it's fair to say that no other type of zone, such as, say, residential, was considered for the airport land because it didn't seem like a very logical fit.
And specifically putting a focus on visitor accommodation in terms of looking at alternatives, Mr. Sargent seems always critical that there wasn't a consideration beyond the airport land of alternatives that might exist there.
I think I can only speak for myself as a planner. I understand there is certainly some ability to develop physical accommodation beyond the bounds of the airport. Say in that remarkable park zone, and there's a hotel there, as you know. So certainly I've been cognizant of that fact all along. I guess your question though as well, if such a proposal was put forward in terms of the visitor accommodation proposal was put forward inside the north boundary on adjacent land, what would the airport strategy be toward it? If I was providing advice to the airport, my advice would be similar to Mr. Dane's. I think things have changed a little bit in terms of people's acceptance of visitor accommodation on airport land or in close proximity to airports in New Zealand, given the experience of has occurred at other places. Certainly when we first looked at Plan Change 35, a bit of a blank approach was taken to any activities of the aircraft ones. There were some exceptions to that.
So something proposed which was not necessarily on all fours but close enough to it, then you'd be advising your airport company client that that was appropriate? Is that sort of accommodation we're talking about?
Yes.
All right. One of the other criticisms Mr. Sargent raises in relation to the Section 32 analysis hinges around traffic effects. And he's saying, well, look, there's just insufficient information about the composition, location, or access provisions to form views for a proper Section 32 analysis. And what's your view about that criticism?
I'm slightly taken by surprise by the criticism, I suppose. Although I didn't see that, I appreciate that the traffic or the transportation assessment that accompanied the Section 32 was somewhat, you know, higher level. But it seemed to me that what Mr. Sargent might have been looking for was more of a more fine-grained analysis, which is quite difficult when you're looking at broad zoning questions. It calls almost for an inventory type approach, i.e. the zone will be this, what exactly will happen inside it, and that is pretty difficult. There's a little bit of tension, I suppose, around the level of detail that has been able to be provided and the level of detail people like.
Principal evidence at attachment 1, which is the remarkable Spartan zone and activity area 8. And you'll be aware to have a policy about airport operations. and 4.1 leads to prohibit activity sensitive to aircraft noise within the out-of-control boundary of Queenstown Airport. That's on page 24 of the I think it's sequentially numbered. So if you find page 24, and then you'll see policies about a third from the bottom of that page.
Right.
So your evidence runs to page, I'm referring to Mr. Sargent's evidence. That is page 24. Any sort of policy, airport operations?
Which policy were you looking at?
It is a policy, airport operations.
Yes.
And it's 4.1. To prohibit activity sensitive to aircraft noise within the out of control boundary of Queenstown Airport.
Yes.
So that's, if you like, the status quo. So if we were minded to move in the direction that the airport company wished to, what's going to happen to that particular policy?
Depends a little bit on whether you regard this type of visitor accommodation that's proposed to be an activity sensitive to aircraft noise. I think the general consensus that visitor accommodation in general is an ASAN. And the definition of ASAN includes visitor accommodation. So the strict interpretation of that does cut against the grain of that policy. Having said that, there are already some limited provision for visitor accommodation to be established in the Plan Change 19 area inside the out of control boundary. So, and that matter was resolved through the Plan Change 19 proceedings, despite the fact that this policy existed, or was being developed in tandem with those proceedings.
So would your view be that we would just leave that inconsistency?
Well, I think it's a limited enough exception to not be overly concerned about that.
Paragraph 8.1 in relation to Wanaka Airport in the summary. You mentioned that existing land constraints will restrict the development of such activities as a justification for why there shouldn't be a land growth plan for area. And you've mentioned a number of times also how the these airports, new airports, are dynamic places in terms of the future of what their needs are. And I guess I was just wondering, in terms of hypothetically, if the Wanaka Airport in particular was going to acquire more land, and then that land would be brought into, it would possibly be a good idea to have that land within this particular zone. Well, then that, would that change your premise for that argument in terms of restriction of land?
Well, it might, but that would be a matter to be considered at the time that any rezoning question was addressed. So say, for example, Wanaka Airport was successful in buying 40 hectares of adjacent land and proposed to rezone that for airport zoning. The questions that arise here in terms of potential distribution of the fee and impact on the existing downtown Wanaka? It needs to be addressed at that point.
Well, wouldn't it be better to have consistency across design and to have that at least some guidance now rather than to look at it in the future?
Well, what I'm saying is that the airport, in terms of the available developable land inside this proposed zone, there isn't sufficient land inside that zone for future development purposes. That should give rise to any significant concern in terms of the distribution of fees. But if there was a great chunk of land available to do that, you need to revisit that question.
For both the grossful area and obviously hours of operation, that is.
That might be one of the methods.
That there's no restrictions on hours of operation.
That might be one of the methods you revisit. You might start looking at things like limiting the area of certain activities. Although the experience I had with those types of provisions are quite clumsy.
Thank you.
Just on Wanaka Airport, can I just clarify the application? No one has provided us with a map showing us where the zoning should apply in Wanaka Airport. Is it to be exactly paralleling the designated area?
That's my understanding, yes.
Right. Whether the council's land holdings go beyond that designated area or not is irrelevant, but purely the designated area.
My understanding is that it's to be consistent with the designated area.
Would the assistant for Mr. Carl to provide you with a map showing the extent of the zone at the same time as the site you were fashion?
Yes, if it's the designated area, then it would be helpful but not essential. The only other question I have is in relation to both airports. The definition of airport activity, whether revised or not, provides for the landing and takeoff of aircraft. Do you consider that if that is to be a permitted activity, the same standards should be applied in the zone as are attached to as conditions to the designation?
You mean with respect to noise generation?
Well, to any of the conditions that I haven't gone through, but there's several pages of conditions in chapter 37 related to the designation.
Mm-hmm.
And if clearly the way that the zone is drafted with the definition of activity, the airport company could uplift the zoning and uplift the designation, which it can do as of right, without any comeback, and those conditions would no longer be relevant to provide on the zoning. Do you think there should be, if we're going to have parallel activities allowed, we should have parallel conditions applying?
I hadn't thought about that scenario.
My mother was just the sergeant. Obviously I started a more Machiavellian planning environment than either of you two.
Indeed. The only conditions I can think of in the designation that would be applicable in that circumstance do relate to the aircraft noise.
Yes, and the level of the number of aircraft, well, the amount of total amount of noise that aircraft arrivals can make. Yes.
Yes, and you know, in circumstances where the airport did take the steps of uplifting the designation, then those conditions wouldn't disappear, so they won't. There's certainly maybe some merit in linking the two.
Mm. Well, I think in Mr. Sargent's proposed rules, he included a reference to those back condition and designation too, but I'm wondering whether if we're going to have this permitted activity, that should just be a standard. You might like to think about whether you could draft something that could come to us on that too.
Yes, I don't think it's reference to designation 2 helps much if designation 2 doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't help at all. But actually, that also is applicable to one of the policies, like it was recommended by the airport company to be in chapter 4, I think it was, or that in terms of being the same as PC 35, there should be a policy relating to the designation, and that may need to, we might need to think about that as well at the same time.
Back to the visitor accommodation issue and question of enforcement and monitoring. Now, Mr. Day touched on it pretty lightly, saying, well, it's just a matter of keeping good records and things of that sort. But wouldn't you agree that this idea of trying to control duration of stay, particularly from the council's point of view, and enforcing the condition could be quite problematic? Just think of the practicalities of it.
I think most hotels keep pretty good records of who's there and for how long.
Keeping the records is one thing. You know, that's just keeping records. But coming along and then saying to a person or checking that you've stayed the requisite number of nights or enforcing the provision, that's quite different. That's the area of interest to me.
So you're a potential guest and someone says to you, time's up for 2 nights.
Yeah, time's up. You go somewhere else. Is that really practical?
Perhaps we put it this way, Mr. Carl, the hotel could keep the records, the council could check the records, and if it discovers that people have stayed longer, what enforcement options are available to the council, because that's happened?
They're in breach of the rules, so they couldn't take enforcement action.
But they couldn't take an abatement notice because it's over.
Well, I send you from the other debate, and I just, you could receive it. I guess from my point of view, there's a bit of a mix of things here. One is, how attractive is it to stay on the airport for more than 2 nights, or 3 nights, for most people? And the discussions that I've had, it's not particularly attractive. Those hotels are more directed at the types of clients that Ms. Treasure described to you. For my part, for example, I could imagine my Auckland holiday being stationed for 5 nights at the hotel at the airport. It's okay for a night or two, but it's not particularly attractive. So that's one element to consider, I think. The other is, I think the hotel operator could be quite forthright around the limitation, and their client can take the lead. If that's the rule, that's the rule. And the economics of the hotel will stand or fall based on that limitation. So any operator will look very carefully at that, I think, and determine whether or not they think it's a viable proposition before they come to construct.
Okay, and slightly different, but still related to the point. When I was talking to Mr. Day about the assessment of the appropriate duration, he made the point that he's quite clear in his mind that 2 days is the answer. But he made mention of the fact that, well, other noise experts may land on a different outcome. It might be 3, 4, 5 days. So with that thought in mind then, do you see that there's a risk here that if you like, the activity is established, the precedent is set, that there's a fertile ground for skilled ear noise experts and planners to say, well, 5 or 6 days, you know, within Kiwi of the airport, still within the plane sensitive noise area as well.
I think Mr. Daisy is quite clear about the issue. Mm-hmm. He clearly sees this as being very much a short-term proposition, and only under those circumstances is it acceptable in that environment. And I understand why does he come to that view.
So you don't, can I interpret your answer to be that you just sort of don't see that there's a risk of slippage or sort of a precedent type argument emerging here?
I think it's said in the plan, clearly, in terms of what the limit is, then it would either necessitate a plan change to change it, or a hotel operator come along and apply for non-compliant activity. And one method available to you as the panel could be to say, well, should that scenario be available, or should any longer term type physical accommodation in the noise boundary actually be approached? And that's a method you could consider.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cole.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll adjourn to 2:10.
Thank you.